Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest this week is CEO of Civic Science, John Dick. John?
Bob.
Good to be here. I met John. We were on a panel for an Axis TV show because Mark Cuban is involved. He's on the board of Civic Science doing Grammy predictions. And John is in town. He sends a weekly email talking about trends in the world at large, because ultimately, what would you call your company? You wouldn't call it a polling company. What would you
call it? I would call us a polling company. I wish there was a sexier way to describe it, but we're a new breed of polling company.
Okay. And he's always revealing fascinating insights, so I thought it'd be great to have him on the podcast. Let's start from the beginning. You're in Pittsburgh.
Correct.
Why Pittsburgh?
It's the next big thing. Pittsburgh is going through a tremendous renaissance, but actually we're there. The company's there because Carnegie Mellon University is there, and the talent and the technology that powers the foundation of our company came from there. And so, and it's a great place to live, and it's a really emerging city with lots of talent, and it's just a smart place for us to operate.
Are you from Pittsburgh?
Born and raised, yeah.
Did you go to Carnegie Mellon?
I did not.
Where did you go to college?
To Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida.
Okay. So then how did you hook up with all these new technology things at Carnegie Mellon?
Well, I had started a company earlier in my early 20s, sold that company in my late 20s.
What was that company?
It was called GSP. We helped early stage tech and biotech companies do business with the government, very different business. And so I exited that company and had the business plan for what became Civic Science shortly after. And I knew it had some technology needs and found a couple guys that knew how to solve those technology needs.
Okay. So why did you want to be in the polling business?
Because it's broken. And well, two reasons. One, it was broken. And two—
That was a little slower. Why is it broken?
Because people don't participate the way they used to, because we're too busy. It's not a pleasant experience for people to participate in polling as it's sort of originally constructed. So my phone's ringing while I'm having dinner, or I have to sign up at some web page and answer surveys all day for $5. And it's just not a user-centric experience for anyone. And so what happened is landline phone ownership started to plummet. And the people who have landline phones don't look like the ones who don't. And so the quality of the data started to suffer. And then pollsters said, well, that's fine. We'll call cell phones. But people don't answer cell phone calls from numbers they don't recognize, or at least the people who do don't look like the ones who don't. And then you had the advent of what are called survey panels, which are these websites people sign up at and answer surveys for money. And those people don't look like either of us. They are too much time on their hands.
Okay, just one other thing. Generally speaking, because you live in a place in Los Angeles, you're constantly getting email, whatever, come participate for $50 or $100. What are those panels worth?
Well, I mean, what are they worth? They certainly are powering a lot of decision-making in commercial America. I don't think they should be, because the people who answer those surveys don't look like the real world. They are people who are highly incentivized by that financial incentive. And so they're heavily biased. And then that financial reward inspires some of the wrong behaviors too, and when you're trying to research someone as opposed to getting their honest opinion about something. So that's all been broken. And it started breaking 20 years ago. It started to the chickens kind of came home to roost in the last election cycle. We see polling just isn't working the way that it used to.
Okay, we got it. We got a bunch of things going.
Sure.
What is the other reason you wanted to go into this business?
Because I think it needs to work. We need to figure out a way to understand what people think. There was a mindset 10 or 15 years ago that social media was somehow going to replace survey research as the way that we understood what the world thinks. And it just doesn't work that way. I'm not myself on social media. I'm a curated version of myself. We need a discrete means of understanding people's opinion. There's a reason we pull a curtain behind us on election day, because if our opinions are subject to scrutiny and peer pressure and invective, then we don't tell people what we think.
Why did everybody get it? So, I mean, now we have Nate Silver, who now presently at 538, used to be the New York Times the previous election cycle. He balances polls. He got it wrong, although he will say he thought the odds of Trump being successful were higher. New York Times got it completely wrong. What did we learn there?
Well, on a national level, from a popular vote standpoint, the pollsters were pretty strong. I mean, they said most of the averages said Hillary Clinton would win by 3%, and she won roughly by 3%. Where it broke down was at state levels, where a couple hundred thousand votes across three or four states were able to swing the election. What did we learn about it in the grand scheme of things was that there was an entire universe of people out there who were pissed off, and we didn't know about it. One of the reasons, and we study this a lot in our own data, conservatives tend to be much less outspoken on social media than their liberal counterparts are. Why? Because they believe that when they speak out on conservative issues, they are opening themselves up to attack from the left. And so they tend to keep their mouth shut. We've studied this extensively. And so there was an entire sub-layer of the U.S. population that was pissed off, but because they weren't trumpeting it from the rooftops on social media, we didn't know about it. And we didn't know about it until November of 2016.
Okay. So you move back to Pittsburgh. You align with these people at Carnegie Mellon. What are the next steps in starting civic science?
Well, we had a lot of technology to build.
What was that technology?
A database architecture designed to kind of find all the stuff we can find in our data. We had to prove that the methodology we were inventing worked.
Now, the methodology you started with, when was this?
2008.
Is that the same methodology you're still employing today?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So explain to my audience what that methodology is.
So we encounter people in polls and quizzes across the web inside of content they're reading. It might be a poll or a quiz you might see on a BuzzFeed or a Facebook of what kind of wine or what kind of Simpsons character are you. But more it's an opinion type of poll of the day that you might find in an article you're reading on your local newspaper or on a site like Perez Hilton or Univision. We're generally asking somebody a couple questions at a time, no more than three or four, because we know that if we add too many questions, we start to see a decline in participation, and that's no good. We give people back instant results, which we think is really important.
So I answer a question, you know, what is my favorite color? And after I click, I'll see what everybody else's favorite color is.
Sure, sure. We don't generally ask favorite color, but you get the idea.
I'm using that as a bland thing.
Sure. Yeah, and we think there's a lot of, particularly today, and what we hear back from people is they appreciate that we're giving them the answers right back. It's unvarnished, unfiltered truth that here's what the world thinks and here's what people like you think, and it's not being passed to you through the lens of a media company that may have some bias.
Now, what is incentivizing them to answer the questions to begin with?
It's that intrinsic benefit of A, feeling like I'm participating in something good, B, the interestingness of the results that I get back, feeling like, okay, I just learned something about the rest of the world by virtue of my participation in it.
And do you compensate the sites where your quizzes are?
No.
So how do they end up being placed there?
It's effectively a bartering arrangement, but what they learn things from the information that we gather that help them grow their businesses. We help them improve their editorial functions and their ad sales.
Okay, so let's say you're on website A.
Mm-hmm.
You would approach them and say, I want to do this, but I'm going to share data with you.
Correct.
That's going to be your compensation.
Correct.
So how many sites are you presently on?
Oh, well over 1,000 at last count. Pieced together to give us a diverse representative view of the U.S. population. So we want to make sure we have ample number of media companies that reach Hispanics and ample number of media companies that reach women and so forth. The media companies make a distinction from us that the size of our poll sitting on their web page, that we are delivering more value to them from that information than they would get from a banner ad that was sitting in that same place. And as long as we can maintain that equilibrium, we can continue to collect that data.
How do you choose what sites to place your quizzes on?
We have a team who goes out and sells that, essentially. And we prioritize sales to publishers or partnerships with publishers who meet demographic imbalances in our sampling. So if we notice over time, hey, we're starting to get a disproportionate number of men answering our polls, we want to go and target sites that have a disproportionate audience of women.
Okay. I am someone who never answers those questions.
Sure.
So that begs the question, are certain people ultimately not included in the sample?
Yes.
What do you do about that?
Well, it's a fundamental flaw. I guess what we tell the marketplace and what we can prove in our research is that because we've limited those barriers as much as possible, that our audience looks more like the real world than any other methodology you would think of. So you're not going to be the person who signs up and answers surveys all day for $5 either. We are all missing some portion of the U.S. population. We're just missing a much smaller portion of the population.
And do you sit in your office and say, how do we reach those people? Or you just tell your customers, some people are unreachable?
We're not giving up. I think we spend a ton of time trying to understand what types of questions or what kind of interaction will bring people who otherwise don't want to participate to participate. And our response rates as a result have gone up a lot. The percentage of people who see our polls on a website and answer them has skyrocketed in the last 2 years because we've invested very heavily in solving that problem.
I would assume it's still below 10%.
Though. Sure, sure. But if you think about how's that relate to, say, the likelihood of somebody clicking on an ad, it's 100 times more than that, right? Because there's something engaging about it as opposed to, oh, I'm going to click on this ad and somebody's going to try to sell me something.
And how many people work at Civic Science now?
25, I think, 26.
And are they all in Pittsburgh?
We have one person in New York.
Okay. So what kind of companies buy your data?
A pretty broad, large ones primarily, very bigger sort of Fortune 500 types of enterprises, consumer-facing companies. We're really strong in tech and telecom, media, banking, healthcare, restaurant, and some retail.
Okay. We were talking off camera, and these are all household names. The names you think they are. But let's assume, point of discussion, telecom. Okay. It is a very competitive marketplace. Everyone already has a smartphone. There are four competitors in the United States. What might you be able to tell a telecom company?
There's going to be a mix of things about attitudes toward their specific company and their specific products. There's going to be a mix of things about trends within their category, so which of their competitors maybe are more vulnerable than others at a given point in time. And then the more valuable stuff we do tends to look at how various larger consumer trends and macro forces are affecting consumers and how that relates to what mobile carriers they're going to use and how much of their plan they're going to use. One thing we learned was really fascinating pre- and post-election was the composition of the people who were likely to switch mobile carriers changed very dramatically from the summer of 2016 through the summer of 2017.
And what did your research tell you?
Democrats were more likely to switch mobile carriers after the election than they were before because they I switch my mobile carrier generally to get a better financial deal, right? And so it tends to correlate with my personal financial situation or my consumer confidence. And so once Donald Trump was elected, a lot of Democrats began to have a bleaker view of the economy and said, you know what, I better go find a better deal for myself. And we saw a higher rate of switchers among Democrats during that period of time, as opposed to the summer before when they tended to be more likely to be Republicans.
Now, sitting here as a layperson, one could say also Sprint was offering comprehensive plans with very cheaper free phones. T-Mobile was very cheap. So one might say really it was plans were so cheap, people were incentivized for that reason as opposed to consumer confidence.
Well, but still there's I chase a cheaper opportunity when I'm looking – when I have a less positive view of my personal finances. So I whether there was cause and effect there or whether those companies were smart enough to capitalize on what they knew was coming, which was more price sensitivity in their core markets, hard to tell.
Okay. Now – many – all these companies do use consumer research, but there is a school of thought that research will tell you where you've been, but it won't tell you where you're going.
Oh, that's the big part of our ethos as we focus on looking through the windshield.
So how do you do that?
We look a lot at patterns and trends in this history of data now that we have. Those trends tend to have a trajectory that we can look 2 months, 6 months out and see where they're headed. We ask a lot of questions that are forward-looking of people. What are your intentions? How likely are you to do something in the future? There's ample backward-looking data that credit card companies have and people on the web have based on things I clicked on yesterday and bought yesterday. We don't need to augment that information. We focus on where are people going to be spending their money next week or next month.
But you look famously, Steve Jobs did no consumer research, and he would come up with products that people literally hadn't heard of, didn't think they needed, and then would clamor for.
Good work if you can get it.
Okay, so he's an anomaly. He's the outlier.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
How about Elon Musk?
Probably of that ilk, but I think those people are the exceptions, not the rule.
Okay. So where's it going?
Well, it's a mix of exciting and terrifying all at once. we are seeing some amazing sea changes right now. A lot of things related. I don't think we fully appreciate yet the impact that social media will have on our culture forever. I think we intuitively get some of it, but I don't think we're going to be able to diagnose any of that for decades. But one of the things that we notice a lot in our data is, and everyone kind of can relate to this, is that because I'm this kind of curated version of myself on social media, I use social media as a way to make myself look funnier and smarter and a better parent and a more adventurous and a better eater. And I think about that consciously or not when I choose what to share or where to check in. The flip side of that is I have a high disincentive to say anything that is unpopular. And so we see, and it goes back to the comment I made earlier about the election, people who believed it was unpopular to support Donald Trump in 2016 just didn't talk about it, but they showed up on election day and did. Now we're seeing it's a little more, people are a little bolder about their support now than they were in 2016. But what's happening is unpopular opinions tend to be suppressed on social media. And so we have a sense of consensus that doesn't really exist.
Wow.
Yes. If you remember the summer of 2015, when the Supreme Court was ruling on gay marriage, it was a very popular thing to have this rainbow-tinted profile picture as a sign of solidarity. Right around that same summer, the South Carolina state legislature was debating taking the Confederate flag down from over the state capitol building. There were no equivalent Confederate flag filters over anybody's profile pictures, which is kind of surprising to me because I grew up in a pretty rural part of Pennsylvania where I know lots of gun-toting, right-wing evangelical Christian types. You'd think that I would have an equal number of rainbow-tinted profile pictures and Confederate flag ones, but I didn't. Because once Facebook had become awash with those rainbow filters, everybody who believed otherwise had a significant disincentive from saying anything to the contrary because they knew they'd be open to attack. So narratives that emerge on social media and take hold are very, very difficult to change. And the impact that has on the popularity of music, the popularity of brands and fashion, it's almost immeasurable today.
Okay, just so I understand, is it a skewed view of reality or does it change reality or both?
Both. I mean, I think what I'm suggesting is that when we look back on this period of history, that it will have changed reality.
Well, I'm a big believer that the reason the younger generation is not as racist and gay marriage is accepted because they saw a rainbow of colors and different choices on MTV when MTV dominated. So are we saying the same thing, that social media will ultimately affect what people believe?
Oh, there's no question about it. I think that it is once a wave of popular opinion washes over, it moves people. It gets them to reconsider their points of view, some. It gets others to really dig their heels in.
So what are we learning with the backlash against Facebook and social media presently?
Well, there's a lot of technical reasons for some of that that I don't think Facebook should be blamed for. This has all been happening so fast. It's not like everybody saw it coming and told Facebook to prepare itself. This was a whole new frontier for them. I think they can fix it. I think what we're learning about from the election through now is and social media is driving a lot of this, which is this incessant kind of tribalism in America that we have, where I want to, and it's affecting this sort of what we call sort of the stay-at-home economy as well. People don't want to go out in public as much as we have a question that we track in our database, which is, would you say that you want to go out, that you're going out more or less than you did 6 months ago? 33% of people in the last time we looked at this data a few weeks ago said that they're going out in public, want to go out in public less than they did 6 months ago. Why? Every time there's a shooting, one person says or more people say, I'm not going to go out today. I'm just going to stay home. And we've made it super easy for people to stay home. And we're controlling our surroundings. We're curating the people that we're around. In 2015, we have a question that says, do you generally like to be around people a lot? It's a very simple question. 34% of people in 2015 said, yes, I like to be around people a lot. Today, that number is 21%. So it's about a 40% decline in that. And that doesn't seem like a huge number. It might. But what it's telling us is people are saying, I don't want to go out and sit in a restaurant and run a risk of sitting next to somebody who's ranting on about some political issue I disagree with. I'm going to stay at my home where I've curated my friend group on social media. I've curated the media that I'm going to read and watch. And I want to create a safe nest around myself. And I think social media has helped to propagate a lot of that.
And so projecting 5 years out as opposed to 3 months, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I think it's going to continue to play out that way. I think we're going to have I think people are – a large portion of people are inherently introverted, but it was always hard to be an introvert. Now I can have everything delivered to my doorstep. I never have to leave to shop. I never have to leave to see a movie. What's happening is the commercial marketplace is moving toward those people. We're saying if you don't want to leave your house, you never have to. Companies are vying to own my quote unquote ecosystem. They want to have my internet, my cell phone, my content, they want my refrigerator to talk to my doorbell, to my smartphone, to my watch on my hand. And companies are all fighting to own that so that when I choose to stay home and never leave, I'm only using one company. And I think maybe 5 years from now that peaks and saturates, but we're far from that.
Stay right there. We'll be back with more of my conversation with John Dick, an expert on polling and analytics, right here on the Bob Lefsetz Podcast. You're listening to the Bob Lefsetz Podcast, recorded here in Venice, California at the TuneIn Studios. Each week, I interview a new guest and dive into their backgrounds, their career, current events, and everything in between. If you like the podcast, subscribe, rate, and review the show, and check out earlier episodes. You can hear them all on TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, or your podcast player of choice. And now, more with John Dick. In light of gun tragedies, have you done any research on that that tells us really what America thinks?
Nothing that would surprise you. I think a lot of people, and this is not just our data, I think most data that you would see would say that the majority of Americans support some stricter interpretation of, if not stricter gun laws, stricter interpretation of the gun laws that we have today. But the political environment is such that people don't want to give any ground. One of the unfortunate consequences of tribalism isn't so much just that I want to kind of organize only with people who agree with me and believe me, but I start finding myself distrusting everybody else. And that's the part of this kind of sociocultural shift that scares us when we look at our data.
Okay. Tell my audience certain things you've learned that are counterintuitive.
There's certainly I felt that it was counterintuitive that we see this trend toward introversion among people because I thought we tended to be more likely to be I thought we were more social beings than we really are. I don't think most of us ultimately want to be. So that kind of surprised me. We see relationships between things that I wouldn't have expected. A few years ago when restaurant spending started to decline in the U.S. and it was kind of inexplicable at the time, traditionally for decades and decades, restaurant spending is really closely correlated to fuel prices.
Why?
Well, because it's disposable income. And fuel prices affects everybody. If I have a couple extra – if I live in a rural town in – middle part of Pennsylvania, or I live in a big city and drive a car, one of the first things that I can notice in my bank account is if I'm spending less money on gas. And so historically, restaurant spending was very closely aligned with shifts in fuel prices. But 2 years ago, restaurant spending was going down and fuel prices were not going up. And we found in our data, which is part of the benefit of being able to study all of these things at once, is that it turned out it was very heavily correlated with how much people were experiencing increases in their health insurance premiums. That was beginning to chip away more at disposable – healthcare costs were beginning to chip away at disposable income at a faster rate than fuel prices were. And that had never happened before.
How do you find that?
Well, because we're studying all of this stuff at once. We look at all these lines on a chart to see how they – which one leads one, lags the other, how related are they? Does one seem to be a cause of another, or do they just tend to follow or lead? And it was pretty evident to us in looking at two – so we have two questions, say. It's actually more complicated than that, but imagine one question is, would you say you're spending more or less to eat out? And another one is, would you say you're spending more or less on your healthcare? And if we looked at the people who answered yes to those two questions, they were closely aligned to one another.
Okay, but sometimes there can be false correlations, correct?
Sure. Yeah, but that's – I mean, really smart statisticians know how to ferret that stuff out.
How do you do it?
Well, you test them. You continue to see if they continue to play out over time. You ask questions different ways to see if it's maybe just an error in the way a person's interpreting the question. We're certainly mindful of that. We have a – it's called a false detection procedure that we use, and it's essentially a coefficient that we use to measure whether there's a false positive in our data.
Wow. No wonder you have the Carnegie Mellon people involved.
Yeah, that's not
me. So did you learn anything else about healthcare?
No. I mean, it's a mess. I think that we saw a period of choice that hadn't existed before because of the Affordable Care Act, and a lot of that's uncertain right now. So it's a – healthcare is a gray area at the moment because we don't know what the future of it's going to look like.
Okay. So you're working with Fortune 500 companies. How would they find you?
They're either referred to us by somebody else we already work with. We publish a lot of information. You mentioned a little email that we do every Saturday morning that finds its way into the hands of leaders. We don't really have – we have a very, very, very small sales force. We're not the kind of company that's trying to barge our way into your office to demo something for you. We typically somebody typically reaches out to us and says, hey, I saw this study you published about this thing and I'd really like to understand how it affects my business. And that's usually where our business
Okay, is. So I hire you. Let's say I'm a software company. Mm-hmm. What will you do for me?
Well, first thing we have to do is understand your business.
How do you do that?
We just spend time together. We have what's called a discovery process and a solution design process, which sounds very bureaucratic, but it's just simply a process of us learning really what your blind spots are as a business. What do you and no one ever knows what those are in the first conversation because they don't think they have any. So we challenge some of that. We ask what they know and we try to push back and we get a sense of, all right, where can we fill in some blanks about their business? I told you earlier, one of the unintuitive things for me is that our biggest clients are companies that you would think don't need any more data. I told you we have sort of one open square on the tech giant bingo card of our business that but all the others we have. And you would I would mention the names of those companies and you'd say, well, I thought they already knew everything about everyone. But what fascinates me about them is that, and I think what's a fundamental truth, is the more data those businesses have, the more questions they have, the more things they don't know. And I think the reason they've become the giants they are is because they continue to be inquisitive and they continue to look under rocks for the next big insight. And those tend to be our best clients.
So let's say you're a big Silicon Valley company, which is collecting reams of data constantly. Mm-hmm. What would you literally provide?
Context sometimes. A lot of the data that those companies have tells you what, but they may not necessarily answer the why.
And you can answer that.
Yeah. The why, our specialty is the why and the what next. Where do we think this is going?
Well, let's talk specifically about the music business.
Sure.
What have you learned about the music business in your research?
It's in a interesting stage of cannibalization. People aren't listening to music more.
Cannibalization, go a little bit deeper.
So there's it's something of a zero-sum game for the players in the space. There aren't more hours in the day. There aren't more people listening to music than listened to it 20 years ago. So
the fact that music is more accessible, people are or are not listening to more music.
There does not appear to be any evidence of that, or at least new people listening to music who weren't listening to it a lot before.
Okay.
And so with all of the providers coming into the marketplace, they are fighting over a finite pool of – and now it's a large pool, don't get me wrong, but there's –
But it's finite.
It's finite. And there is not room for – there's certainly room for, you know, multiple providers, but only to the extent that they are dividing up our attention. I think we will see some consolidation and I don't mean necessarily from a business standpoint, one company buying another necessarily, but I think we will see more and more – music listeners gravitating to single sources of music than we have.
Well,
right
I believe
now.
That for different reasons. We live in a winner and loser economy across right. the board. We have income inequality, et cetera. You want to go where your friends brands are, and the successful companies have 65%+ market share online. They're all a click away.
Right. And I think, well, that's a part of the virtuous circle. It's easier, but it's also desirable. Same thing with the kind of the at-home tech ecosystem. If I have fewer passwords I have to remember, fewer tech support people I have to call, fewer interfaces I have to learn, I mean, that's as desirable to me as my refrigerator talking to my doorbell would be. It's just the simplicity and the convenience of it. I think that's all driving. It's driving what we expect to be a rapid pace of consolidation, particularly in all media, but music in particular.
Okay, so let's just assume there'd be fewer places that you would ultimately gravitate to listen to music, or they have larger market share. What about the acts themselves?
Well, we don't need our data to tell anyone, and you know this better than we do, that it's just much, much easier for people to record a song, right? It's happening at an almost immeasurable pace because I can just take a quick video of myself and slap it on YouTube. I think we are, because of a lot of the trends we see in social media, I know you have some thoughts on virality. Things can go from small to big very fast, but they can also go from big to small very fast with a misstep. And I think the adoption curve of everything, including music, is truncated, so it's happening much faster than it did years ago because there's fewer barriers to entry.
The adoption curve, what is that?
Well, it's the extent to which there are people out there who will try everything. There are music fans who will listen to every single artist they hear about. And then we call those an early adopter. There's a second phase, a group of people we'll call a market maven in our terminology, which is I try it and then I tell everyone about it. And I go to social media and I say, look at these songs I listen to, check out this band that I like. And those people have a lot of power today. My sister's one of those people in music. When she tells me about a band a year later, they're at the Grammys. You know, she's always been that way. But there's a third group of people then who wait for those market mavens to tell them what to think. They don't want to make decisions for themselves. They're not doing a ton of their own research, going and reading reviews or any of that. They wait for those friends they have, like I do with my sister, who says, oh, you should go check out this band because I don't have time to follow music.
Well, now with an overwhelming number of marketing messages, is the percentages of early adopters, market mavens, and passive listeners, have those numbers changed percentage-wise?
Not really. In fact, we're working on a study on this right now. It's remarkably consistent, the percentage of people that fall into those buckets. But what's happening is the progression from one group to the next is happening much faster because the connectivity between the early adopter to the market maven to the lemmings who wait for those market mavens to tell them what to do, we're just much closer to each other than we ever were before. So every time I turn on Facebook, there's the likelihood of my sister posting some song that she just listened to that inspires me to listen to it, where 5 years ago I had to wait for her to call me on the phone to do that.
Yes, but also I would argue that there's so many messages that it is harder to get somebody to click or harder to pass on your information today.
From a marketing standpoint, sure. So that's why social media is so powerful, because I don't know what else to trust, but if my sister tells me, that's different. And that's a hard thing for brands and marketers to get their head around. The power of the influencer, which isn't necessary, and I don't mean a YouTube influencer as much as I mean somebody in my social network who I trust. One thing that we've seen in our data indisputably over the last 4 or 5 years, we track things like which of these kinds of advertising has the most influence over your purchase decisions, TV, radio, print, whatever. One of the lines on that chart is comments and recommendations from my friends on social media, and that line has climbed and climbed. It surpassed television for the first time 2 summers ago and has stayed there. So I trust, because I don't know what other media to trust, and that's actually getting worse, right? We can't discern fake news from real news anymore, so the only thing I can trust is what my sister tells me.
So what is the future of advertising?
I think what we're seeing and what we're telling our clients is that they have to understand that adoption curve, and they have to understand that the way you communicate to an early adopter is different than the way you communicate to a market maven, which is different than the way you communicate to that third tier.
So to what degree are people just tuning out advertising completely?
Oh, a lot. I think you've seen the advent of so-called native advertising in the last 5 or 6 years. So it's advertising masquerading as a news article. Advertising has to be a lot less obtrusive in my life, or intrusive. And what you're seeing is brands focused on creating a, more of an ongoing connection with somebody so they don't feel like I'm being advertised to all the time. It's a much more subtle process than it was 20 years ago.
Okay, we'll return to this conversation with John Dick, CEO of Civic Science, in a moment. This is Bob Lefsetz. I'm a writer, and you can read me at lefsetz.com. If you haven't noticed already, I love getting a person's story. I like to know what makes them tick, specifically as it relates to successful people who are changing the game in their respective field. I'm eager to get to the bottom of it on this show. In that same vein, I'd like to invite you to attend my Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara the last weekend in April. It's going to be a great way to connect with the movers and shakers in the world of tech and music. Go to musicmediasummit.com for tickets and more information. And now, more with John Dick. Let's go back to lessons you've learned. You were telling me earlier that you learned that Android users correlate with more heart problems.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, those are the kind of fun and quirky but often useful things in our data. When you study 100,000 different questions that have been answered a billion times, you find relationships between stuff that, yes, if you have an Android phone, you're 41% more likely to have a history of heart disease in your family. That is not causality. That doesn't mean if you switch phones, you won't have heart disease. It means that the types of people who have Android phones are the types of people who tend to have a higher rate of heart disease in their family. And there's income and other kinds of proxy reasons for that, which makes lots of sense when you explain it. But if I'm a marketer at a pharmaceutical company, that's a pretty useful discovery to find in a database that that relationship exists. One of our absolute favorites is there is a staggering correlation between how much people like Gary Busey and how much they like Kia cars. Never been able to explain it. But I can tell you, I can tell you 5 or 6 years ago that little bit of information formed the catalyst of a television campaign for a regional network of Kia dealerships starring Gary Busey.
And did that work for them?
It worked like a charm.
Wow. Okay. Well, a little bit more. How did you find that correlation?
Same thing. So we just have these really smart people and smart technology that crawls around in all of this data all the time and looks for those kinds of things. So the kind of unexpected insight that one of our kind of marketing shticks is that we answer questions you never thought to ask.
And okay. So do you go further and try to – okay, Gary Busey, he has kind of an irreverence who gives a shit about life. And if you're driving the Kia Squirrel car,
sure,
it's kind of an ugly car, but you're sort of saying the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, eventually you find – the why. And as I mentioned, I think that's the kind of the gray space we're trying to fill in the world is why is that true? So finding that it's true is one thing. Understanding why it's true is another, because the advertising or marketing or product decisions that inspire have to be – they can't just be, oh, I don't know why, but we're going to do it anyway. We have to help them understand why.
Okay. So you're on a roll now. Tell us some more things you've learned in the data.
Oh, geez. There are things that millennials are more likely to pick rock and rock, paper, scissors than other generations. Yeah.
I'm trying to think what do we learn from that?
Well, you can learn how to take money off of millennials at rock, paper, scissors.
Yes.
Yeah. That one's kind of trite. Well, I mentioned the healthcare and restaurant spending. Those are the more serious kinds of useful, impactful things.
Well, irrelevant of whether it's counterintuitive, what other things might one learn? Well, if someone is an iPhone owner, what did you learn about iPhone owners?
Well, I can't touch that one. What I can say is we find one of my favorite areas of study is height. There are tons and tons of correlations in our data tied to whether somebody is taller or shorter than their peer group or people their age and gender. There's sociological reasons why that's true. But taller people have different brand preferences. They have different media consumption habits than shorter people do. And why is that? So we know over history, taller people generally, when they were younger, were better at physical sports than others. They tended to – that bred some confidence that manifests itself in the classroom, that maybe helped a tall person stand out, say, in a job interview or an admissions interview for a college. And you do that millions and millions and billions of times over human history. And there are certain proclivities that tall people have that short people don't, and vice versa. And it's not always – benefiting the tall people, by the way. But we have a question in our database that essentially is like, are you taller or shorter? And people answer that question because they want to know how they compare to other tall people and other short people. But when we've asked that question hundreds of thousands of times and studied millions of things about people based on their height, we find that there are indisputable relationships between your height and your consumer behavior, for example.
Can you remember any specific correlations?
Yeah, some of them are funny. I mean, very obvious ones. Shorter people are less likely to go see live music.
Because they can't see it?
I think that's your answer. That's probably your answer. Actually, the way the insight was that shorter people were actually more likely to watch Axis concerts on television.
Now, in the music business, we've gone to so-called, you know, festival seating in that the people stand. I personally hate it. I remember the old days when there was a seat at the Fillmore East.
Sure.
Now, the live companies will tell you they can only put in a certain number of people because of fire marshal rules. That's a bunch of crap. They squeeze more people in if they're standing. But would their business be increased if they had seats and the short people could see?
One would think, yeah. I mean, certainly if there's an extent to which there's a person choosing not to buy a ticket to a concert because they don't feel like they're going to be able to see well enough when they get there, that's would seem to me to be a pretty obvious measure for them to take.
Wow, that's very stimulating. Let's go to the reverse.
Is it really? Okay.
No, it really is because I think this goes back to your point that you're advising or working with household name companies, Silicon Valley companies, who we think have all the data, but their insights, I mean, this is something I focus on, there's a lot of institutional beliefs that I don't think are true, and the data can help prove otherwise.
There are certainly truisms that have at least evolved, if not are inherently untrue.
Like what?
You're really putting me on the spot for some of these.
Okay.
No, I'll think of millennials today. So I feel like I talk about them all the time because that's so much of what our clients want to know about. But this sort of trend towards introversion among consumers is really being driven by a millennial population. They're going to bed earlier. They're waking up earlier. They're drinking less. There are lots of trends about young people today that young could be anywhere from, 35 and under, that are perceived to be a function of their generation. Oh, millennials aren't going to drive cars because
right.
Millennials – well, we want to draw a distinction between what's a generation and what's a life stage phenomenon. So, yeah, 24-year-olds don't want to drive cars. I didn't want to drive a car when I was 24 either. But all of a sudden you grow up and you have kids and you've got to truck them around to soccer practice. Guess what? Millennials are starting to buy cars. There were gloom and doom stories 10 years ago that the auto manufacturers were screwed because millennials were just going to take Uber and ride public transportation everywhere they went. And it's just not true. We had a call a few years ago from the director of a very large zoo who called to ask why millennials weren't coming to the zoo. Now, this might have been longer, 6-7 years ago. They were freaking out because millennials weren't coming to the zoo. And I said, did 25-year-olds ever come to the zoo? Right? We want to draw these sort of hyperbolic conclusions about things that quote-unquote millennials are doing today. But there were 22-year-old millennials. I mean, so millennials technically, what, roughly 18 to 34 today. Think of the life stages that encompasses. I could be 22 smoking pot sitting on my parents' couch, or I could be 33 with two kids and a mortgage and two cars in my garage. And so to make some blanket statements about what's definitively millennial versus definitively Gen X versus baby boomer is a mistake.
Okay, but let's go on a broad scale. In what ways are millennials different from the generations they preceded them?
Well, certainly digital connectivity and media consumption are absolutely true. These phenomena of the stay-at-home economy and the tribalism I mentioned before, whether they're causing it or whether they will be the first generation to live fully within the confines of that, I don't know. But it's certainly going to be the latter. They are definitely going to be – they are driving an era of people staying in echo chambers, confining themselves to a smaller group of people that they can curate and can – same thing with their media consumption.
Well, you can't open a major publication without people either selling or analyzing ways to interact with millennials.
Correct.
Like, especially in millennials, you know, you can't say anything negative to them. They're going to cry. They're going to quit. Is that all horse shit or is that true?
I think that's a little overblown. I mean, most of the people in my company fit the definition of a millennial, and I don't find that to be true at all. I think those are fun stories for people to tell. I don't have the gloomy view of, you know, millennials killing the fabric of America that you read a lot of. I think it's overblown. I'll tell you another thing that's maybe a truism that we can dispel is that this is a huge sort of shift of topic. One of the biggest fallacies in the world today is that Donald Trump uses Twitter to talk to the American people. The American people are not on Twitter. 24% of Americans at most are on Twitter, 11% of his voters, give or take. He is using Twitter to talk to the media who carry his message to their little tribes of people who read it. And so he doesn't care, and it's actually quite brilliant. I have to tip my hat to the way he handles it. I mean, he tweets at 3 o'clock in the morning because he knows he's setting the media landscape for he's telling the media what they're going to talk about that day. And he doesn't care what CNN says about him because his followers aren't watching CNN anyway. People don't trust information anymore. They trust the distributors of that information. And so Donald Trump seeds his fairy dust into Twitter, and those publications run it to their individual tribes of readers. One of the more profound trends that we see today is even as consumption of every other form of media is in decline. Television ratings are down, sports are down, newspaper readership is down, radio listening is down. The one thing that is skyrocketing is the readership of political blogs, political content online, which is a harbinger of an ill future for so-called objective media outlets, because I don't want objective media. I want media that affirms my existing beliefs, and now there's so much variety out there that I can go find it. And it tends to be a blog who isn't trying to appeal to the masses, that can tell me exactly what I want to hear every time I click on the webpage. And Donald Trump has come along in an era where he's benefiting from that immensely. So he puts out his two morning tweets, and it's carried directly to the people he wants it carried.
And do you believe he's consciously doing that?
I mean, I think so. I think he knows that he's communicating to his supporters through the megaphones of the media outlets that support him.
What has your research told you about the midterm elections?
Well, funny you should ask that, because just today I was reading a report on some of our data that is speaking of we're seeing after 16 months of very positive growth in consumer sentiment, we've started to see over the last month a fairly significant decline. Consumer confidence, economic sense, people's attitudes toward the job market and their personal finances and the outlook for the U.S. economy seems to have peaked and is now beginning to slide.
Do you have any thought as to why that is?
Well, I think there was an artificial high in the first place. There was a lot of sizzle, not a whole lot of steak, in terms of there was just optimism for optimism's sake. There was a large sector of the U.S. consumer population who just believed things would get better. They tended to be Republicans and the people who voted for Donald Trump in the first place, even though they maybe not necessarily had any reason to feel that way. And so next Tuesday in my hometown, there's a very significant midterm special congressional election that the president's going there on Saturday. Joe Biden was there yesterday. And we're not in the political prognostication business, but there's reason to believe that this downturn in consumer sentiment, because we do know that that affects election cycles, could have an impact as soon as next Tuesday on a very important – it's a razor-thin margin in that election, and that could be the kind of downturn that might tip it in the favor of the Democrat.
And Trump himself. Now, we read about his approval rating constantly. Is that worth anything?
Sure. I think so. I mean,
is it accurate?
The aggregate of and one thing we admire a lot about Nate Silver is he does take into consideration a lot of different sources. And if you normalize for the biases of one versus the other, and those numbers, his approval numbers are fairly consistent. What matters more is who shows up to vote. his approval ratings haven't barged much at all. And frankly, you know, there was I think the estimate was about 35% of U.S. adults actually voted for him. If you take into consideration the people who are registered to vote and the portion that actually came out and voted for him, we're talking about just over one-third of the entire U.S. population. And that's roughly, give or take, 3-4 points at a time, the people who still approve of him. And so public approval doesn't mean anything unless 100% of people vote, and we know that they don't. And the biggest problem that pollsters have isn't can I measure public opinion, it's can I predict who's going to turn out on election day.
Okay, we talked about millennials. What have we learned about baby boomers?
Well, I have to putting my personal points of view aside on it.
You consider yourself a Gen Xer?
I am a Gen Xer.
So should we start what we learned about Gen Xers?
Yeah, I mean,
conventional wisdom would be they're a smaller bulge than the baby boomers.
True.
They were in the wake of the baby boomers. They feel on some level they missed out on Woodstock in the heyday, and they feel that the baby boomers raped and pillaged to their detriment.
I think the latter is true. I'm not necessarily sure we feel like we missed out on much. I think we feel like we're responsible to clean up one group's mess to make things better for another group, and we're not going to get a benefit from either of them. That is not a data driven. That is a purely that is a purely subjective point of view of my own on the subject. But we do see, so bringing it back to data, we see much lower divorce rates among Gen Xers. We see if you look at sort of declines in crime rates over the last 20 years in the U.S., I'm not saying that we're a more virtuous generation. We just maybe didn't have as much time we're all very busy. What we do see, one of the biggest trends that's being driven by Gen X is the shift in gender roles in the family. Household responsibilities are shifting more and more towards women, and men aren't picking up the slack. And that doesn't mean, you know, women are making more larger household decisions about real estate, banking, things that used to be kind of traditionally male decisions. Women are making more of those decisions than they did in the past, and men aren't doing much more. I mean, there are men doing more cooking and more grocery shopping, but they're not doing it at a rate that outweighs the increased responsibility women are taking on in households. We have a piece that we wrote a couple years ago that still gets circulated around a lot, and it was entitled "Women Are Getting a Terrible Deal" because of that. You've got multi-spouse working or multi-partner working households. Women are while still making less money than men overall, are starting to make more money and carrying as much responsibility for households, and men are starting to be free riders a little bit more than we were before.
And to the degree you've researched this, what about the Me Too movement?
We don't research that very much.
Because it's unresearchable or your clients don't demand it?
No, I mean, not all the research we do is because clients demand it. A lot of our clients say, go research what's important and come back and tell us the truth. You know, we are out there searching for truth, and then we share it with the people we think can benefit from the knowledge. And I think the Me Too movement is somewhat related to this topic of male entitlement that is pervasive or has been pervasive for years. I think that's starting to lift. I just don't think there's a whole lot we can add to the discussion about it. It's a huge problem. It's wrong. There's just not a lot of nuance that any data is going to say about how right or wrong or how wrong it is.
Okay, so what about baby boomers? You remember any insights on the baby boomers?
Well, I mean, yes. Baby boomers are much closer to their kids than generations before them, and that has a lot of effect on how they're making decisions about their health care and everything from their consumer decisions. We work with a number of healthcare companies who sell devices. I'll use an example of like a sleep apnea company. They have a sleep apnea machine. So for years and years and years, you would advertise to the person who suffered from sleep apnea. Well, should you really, or should you advertise to the spouse who lives with the person with sleep apnea? And so we've seen that shift, of course. But across other areas of healthcare, when it comes to medical devices, like say maybe not sleep apnea where I can't sleep because the person beside me is snoring, but other ailments like COPD or what have you, the millennial is a significant influence over the baby boomers' decisions, and they're because they're closer than they were before. So we are challenging our clients to think a lot about advertising or influencing baby boomers by influencing the people who influence them. And that is a trend that we've seen shift quite a bit.
So ironically, because baby boomers think they know everything, they don't.
Well, they may still think they do.
Right.
But they're
influenced by other things.
They are. And a lot of it is driven by the closeness of the relationships they've maintained with their kids, which is a very good thing, by the way, that there is they're either reliant on their younger children or they've just had a closer relationship through as their kids got older. And when you hear the stories of the millennials who are still, you know, living in their parents' houses, there's one of the positive ends of that is the relationships between them tend to be pretty good, pretty strong.
Okay, we'll return to this conversation with John Dick, CEO of Civic Science, in a moment. Hi, this is Bob Lefsetz. My guests come to the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California to have these conversations with me. And if you ever want to see what they look like or where we tape the show, check out the photos and videos. Search at TuneIn on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And now, more with CEO of Civic Science, John Dick. Now, what about more macro trends? You mentioned cars. What is the future of automobiles? Because we read all the time in the straight media that, you know, autonomous driving is coming.
So that's definitely something we study very closely. The vast majority of people are still very scared about autonomous vehicles, particularly women do not want to get in a car that's driving itself.
By the same token, we see things flip overnight. Like we heard digital photography was going to replace film for at least 10 years, and then with the space of 12 months, seemed like film disappeared and digital came upon us.
Right.
So a lot of people are fearful, but then when the product comes and their influence, it's like AOL. You know, no one was online, then all of a sudden for a couple of years, everybody was buying a computer just to get online. So I'm just asking, when people are fearful of something, could the switch be faster than it used to be?
It could be, but it also, in the case of autonomous vehicles, could go the other direction too. It only takes one hacker in some Eastern Bloc country to take over a bunch of cars with a computer and drive them into a crowd of people that no one's ever going to want to get into a driverless vehicle for 20 years. I think that there's enough fear and skepticism about autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence in general that a couple bad PR nightmares for one of those cars doing what it's not supposed to could kill it. There's no reason to believe that will happen, but you could certainly foresee a situation where whatever momentum driverless cars are gaining could be stopped in its tracks. I think it's more likely we'll see an evolution toward autonomous vehicles like we see evolution toward alternative fuels, alternative energy. You've got huge infrastructure in the automobile industry and the fuel industry that are going to slow a lot of that progress down. And then you've got a lot of people who are just skeptical about or simply uncomfortable with the idea of being in a car that they can't control. So I don't expect it to be an overnight thing. And there's nothing in our evidence. The evidence in our data is that the percentage of people who are comfortable with a driverless car has not grown much in the last 2 years. It's the same group of people.
I vastly disagree with this.
Okay, great.
Just because I think that's what people believe, but I think we had the Tesla accident in Florida where the guy crashed into a car. These stories are really amplified. And of course, we're talking about the pace of change happens more quickly these days. But if you go back to even in the commercial jet age in the 60s, they did not have the flight control that they have today, and they had accidents. Okay. People were fearful. They're still fearful today. Even the odds of having an accident are really low. But the barrier to entry to getting a ticket because of deregulation in airlines, there's a lot of things that may not be directly applicable. But when the person next door gets a car, or can be even better, can call up a car like Uber, and you don't have to own a car, you don't have to have a garage, I think the pace of change happens very quickly. I mean, I look at this like the internet. Most of the public was not internet savvy. And over the course of 1 to 5 years, everybody was internet savvy. So I'm not sure I agree with that. What about climate change? You learn anything with climate change?
That's not something we study a lot. People are pretty set in their mindsets about that. We don't see a lot of change. I will go back. So I appreciate your your argument on the driver. And let me say that I'll be the first person to call that driverless car to come pick me up. So I'm hoping it comes as fast as possible because I could do away with my car in a second. And I think there is a chance that that could happen. All I'm saying is there's also a chance it could go the other direction pretty quickly.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is something, it's irrelevant of driverless cars. One, to what degree are stories being amplified that ultimately have no impact? Okay, there was a story back when these portals used to be of much greater impact. I think it was on Yahoo. They had a big thing saying tongue splitting was a big thing, okay? Right. Where you literally split the end of your tongue, whatever. In reality, there were fewer than, I believe, certainly fewer than 10. I think it was fewer than 5 people who'd ever done. There wasn't really a trend.
Right.
But people were writing about it. It's sort of the flip side of the people with unpopular opinions. We're not putting them on social media.
Right.
So these stories that are amplified, this is something that's changed in the internet. There used to be something called a turntable hit. Well, all the gatekeepers say we're going to bang something, and it looks like it's popular, but the public isn't buying it. Now we can see whether the public buys it.
Sure.
So I think the New York Times is the best we've got. I don't want to make it right about right or left. It's just that they have boots on the ground in all these places other people don't.
Right.
Okay. But now more than ever, the mainstream media will print. I'm not talking about printing hard news, okay? There was a war here. That's something different. But when they print softer news, I think it has less impact and less accuracy than it ever did before.
That's indisputable. It's getting worse by the day. 2 weeks ago when people were – I had half dozen friends of mine on social media shared a story about the idea that the students in Parkland were – what were they? Crisis actors.
Right.
That meant so there were 117,000. The one article that I saw had been shared 117,000 times. The average Facebook user has 368 friends. That means roughly, 37-some million people saw that article from a friend, leading them to believe it was true, right? So it doesn't – so the scale at which misinformation can spread is – and we will retract from that as consumers because we're going to only get burned by that so many times. So you're absolutely right. I think that's happening. And I think it will take 5 misguided stories about bad driverless cars probably could spoil some group of people. The pace of misinformation, I don't know where that ends, by the way. I hope that people wise up and become more scrutinizing in what they believe, but maybe they won't.
I don't believe people, you know, it's interesting, you're selling data and analysis. I don't believe the average person has the power of analysis.
Oh, no. That's why I was saying earlier, I think one of the biggest challenges we face is an erosion of trust of data. We talk so much about big data and data science and all of that, but I think the average consumer distrusts numbers because based on who puts those numbers in front of them. I mentioned to you earlier when we were talking that we've been approached by media outlets about sort of publishing or syndicating our numbers, and we just won't do it because all of a sudden we lose, we inherit the perception of bias that those outlets have if they put their names on.
But the irony, and I'm sure you're hearing it anyway, is people believe you're biased anyway.
True. True, but I can sleep better at night if I have some control over
it. Well, I know. I mean, I write about Spotify and every day I get people say, well, you're on the payroll. I'm not on the payroll. I never took a cent. Okay. I'm not saying therefore the opposite is going to happen. I'm going to take the money. But even if you are lily white clean these days, people believe you're not.
Oh, I mean, we'll put one blog post out about a topic and on our Facebook page, we'll be in the same by one person accused of being a right wing shill. And on the next comment will be a left wing shill. I mean, people will find the story they want to find if your data doesn't precisely affirm their existing belief.
What's a sad state of affairs? I mean, I grew up in an era where there were many fewer media outlets, and you could agree on the facts. You can't even agree on the facts anymore.
No, you cannot. No.
And it's hard to give it. So any other macro trends that you can give us? You're talking about the cocooning, which ironically is what Faith Popcorn said a few decades back. But now we have the ability with all these Instacart and Netflix to do that. Any other macro trends in the public?
Well, so I mentioned the aspirational nature of social media and what that's doing. The impact that's having on brands, I think, is pretty dramatic in terms of I was on a – I gave a talk at a conference about a year ago. It was a beauty industry conference, and I sat with a woman who was an executive of a big beauty company, and she was telling a story about how the night before she had driven her son – she was taking her son to – we were in New York. She was taking her son to soccer practice, and I picture her in her Land Rover in Westchester.
Right.
Right. And he hadn't eaten dinner yet, so she drove him through the drive-thru at a fast food restaurant to get him some burgers. And she gets to the soccer fields, and all the suburban Westchester moms were standing there, and she has a panic attack that these moms are going to see that she'd taken her son to this fast food restaurant. So she's telling the story, and we're all laughing, but she stands up, and she's shoving the stuff in her bag so that moms won't see it. And so we've been materialists since one person had a nicer loincloth than the other, right? It's gone back as much as, you know, as far back as you can go. Janis Joplin wrote about it in 1970. But we've never had the tools to, or the fear that our purchase and consumption decisions were on public display like they are now. And this was a case of a woman driving to a parking lot with food in her car. But with the cameras and the social media and the sharing and the posting and all that, the decisions that I make about where I eat and where I buy are on public display and subject to scrutiny like they've never been before. So we've always had guilty pleasures, and I may choose not to eat at a particular fast food restaurant because it's unhealthy for me. But if I do, I just don't post about it or brag about it. But what about that woman who next time her son hasn't eaten dinner, she actively chooses not to go to that fast food restaurant because of the potential trauma of being seen taking her son there? Now, that very large fast food restaurant just lost a customer, or at least a visit. And think about how often that might be happening at the scale. And you look at some of these large brands, the blue chip CPG companies and others there are a lot of reasons they can explain some of the declines that they've had, but that has to be a big part of it, is that it's just not cool to go there. It's not as cool to eat there. And I think that's going to affect music as well. I think being able to brag about the concert I was at, and that's always been there, but it's never been amplified the way that it is now.
Staying with the same thing, because this crosses bounds, we learn that acquisition is down and experiences are up, especially amongst millennials. Is your data—
Absolutely. Very true. Yes. Wanting to experience—restaurant spending is down, but the types of restaurants that people are choosing to eat at are more experiential. So certain types of restaurants are doing well. Travel is certainly up. It's making it—it's a—it's quite a big blind spot for the Fed in terms of forecasting consumer spending, because a lot of those categories aren't measured by a lot of the federal resources in terms of, it's not— store receipts from Target and Walmart anymore. There's money being spent somewhere that's not as visible. And that is a fundamentally true trend. And it's not just millennials. It's happening in Gen X as well.
Okay. So if someone wants to check you out, they can listen to this podcast. Is there anywhere they can go online to see some of your data other than your quizzes?
It's civicscience.com. Pretty straightforward. Anybody who would like to, you mentioned earlier that little Saturday email that I send out, it's kind of invitation only, but it is an awesome list of people who read it. And if anybody would like to be added to that, they could reach out to you maybe to do that.
Okay.
But otherwise, civicscience.com. And, we write a lot. It's, our blog is a lot of content every week, new things we're studying, trends we're finding. We do have some partnerships with some media outlets that take our information and give it a spotlight for us. But they can certainly reach out to us if they want to be added to any of the distribution lists of these kind of things that we're writing about.
And once again, we haven't mentioned the names of the companies that employ Civic Science, but I know those names, and believe me, they're all the alphabet soup that you believe they are. So once again, John Dick, CEO of Civic Science, thanks so much for being here on the Bob Lefsetz podcast.
It was my pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
That wraps up this week's episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast, recorded here in Venice, California at the TuneIn Studios. I hope you enjoyed this fascinating conversation with the CEO of Civic Science, John Dick, about market analytics, the future of tech, the music industry, and consumer habits. As always, I welcome your feedback. Email me at bob@lefsetz.com.